Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and today we're going to be talking with our good friend, Julie Rabinowitz. How are you, Julie?
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good morning. You have a new title, Director of Policy, Operations, and Communications.
Yes, I've taken on the legislative liaison role in developing policy and overseeing rulemaking at the department.
That's excellent. Well, congratulations.
Yes, thanks.
That's good. All right. So, you know, the legislature, the 127th state legislature just finished.
Yes.
To say it was a little bit different than the normal legislative session would be probably an understatement.
Well, I think they're each unique, but this year had some special events.
It had some special events. So we're not going to talk about the special events. We're going to talk about some substance.
Right.
But I think it would be nice to say that it was a unique session. Let's just put it that way. Anyways, that's my arbitrary commentary here, ladies and gentlemen. So tell me a couple of the things that are some of the bills that did not make it through. Because we'll get to the stuff that did.
Yes.
Well, what's the stuff that didn't make it through that might interest HR professionals and business leaders?
Well, I think what's important to know is that there are some national trends in legislation that are being proposed at the state level and also in some of the larger cities. Obviously, minimum wage increases are one that we've talked about on this show before and is definitely a conversation that's happening in Maine. If we can't change it at the state level, let's go to doing it at the city or municipal level. But there's also some other bills that have been trending and are a couple are unique to Maine, but also some that are national things that we can just point out. So one is the Retail Workers Bill of Rights. And that's something that has been largely about work schedules, about giving employees more notice and more control over their schedule, and also penalizing employers if they don't meet certain time schedules. And that did pass. I believe it's passed in a city. I think it might be San Francisco. But that did not pass in Maine, although it did get generate some significant discussion at the Labor Commerce Research Economic Development Committee, LCRED, in the State House.
You know what's interesting about that? My background's retail, obviously. And I recognize the challenge of scheduling for a retail environment because it ebbs and flows with the customer flow. And you can have a great plan, an absolute plan of scheduling people each day and all shifts filled. And then here in Maine, when it rains,
yes,
and you have the outlet centers, and they absolutely explode. You need to call people in. You need to have people available to call in. This really can be a hindrance to a huge part of what Maine's about.
Right, and that was a large part of the testimony against the bill, was that our retail sector is very largely tourism-dependent, and if you're a tourism-dependent Maine business, you are weather dependent for a large degree, whether it's, as you mentioned, when the weather is bad in your store gets a lot of traffic because you don't want to go to the beach, you go to the outlets. Or if you're at the beach and the weather's bad, so your gift shop, your whatever, you just don't need as many staff that day. And in having the ability to call people in or out is needed, and it's not really something we should penalize the gift shop owner in Old Orchard for, or in Booth Bay, because it's been raining for 3 days, and they don't need this many people in the shop.
It's absolutely true, and so it's interesting what the bill actually appears to do is create an environment in which owners, employers, have to really be careful how they handle this, yet the consumer who wants great service, who wants people at the cash registers when they want it, we know that, right? That when they want it, don't understand why we can't bring people in because of these regulations and changes that people are talking about. It really seems counterproductive.
Yeah, so, I mean, that bill did die, but it is part of this larger trend,
and it will come back. That's what makes me nervous about it.
Yes, it will come back. And we're watching what happens in other states. We believe that at least one state did pass a modified version of that this year, so we'll see what happens.
Great. What's another bill that didn't make it through this year, but we should keep an eye on?
An act to create a public option pension system. This is another one that's being proposed in the California's kind of states where they want to have the state house a pension system. The bill that was proposed this year would have given that pension system to the Department of Labor, which is kind of why it's on my radar in particular. But we believe at in the LePage administration that the private sector is handling the pensions pretty well. And there's a lot of options, 401ks, 403bs, SEOs. There's all these things depending upon what kind of business you are in, what kind of, you know, the size of your business, whether you're for profit or not. There's options. We do not need in a state the size of Maine the state investing money. Just the technology cost we estimated for the state to implement a computer system that would track and manage a pension system would be over $20 million. Just to have the technology of it. And that's not enforcement.
That's right. Training people, enforcement, right.
Educating employers about what this pension system would be and what it would do. And do we really need to duplicate what the private sector is doing at a reasonable cost for employers and for employees at the state level?
Okay, so that died.
That died.
I'm sure it will come back. I'm sure it will come back.
And then we had some kind of some quirky bills that came in that I thought would kind of be fun to talk about. We had one bill which was called an act regarding the sick days of an employee who is terminated while on sick leave, and that bill wanted it mandated that if your company had sick leave, not paid time off, PTO, or vacation time, but paid sick leave, and you had an employee who called in sick or was out on sick leave, and you terminated them, that you would have to pay all their back sick leave, but only if you terminated them while they were out sick.
The possibility of that happening is pretty darn low.
And it,
I mean, I'm trying to think of what scenario would actually have that happen. And the only thing I could possibly think of, and I'm just thinking off the cuff here, and I'm working hard to come up with an idea, is if you find out because somebody's not there that somebody's stealing. Or you find out that something in that, and that you find out something because they're not there, right? Something has happened because you're not there.
Right.
But that's an obscure...
In the complications of that, because if you're out sick, well, there were a couple of scenarios that we thought of at the department. So you were out sick, say you were hospitalized or something, and then a layoff occurred while you just happened to be out sick. So, and I think that that's the true life instance that inspired this bill. And it's an unfortunate situation because you have banked sick time, but you're not entitled to that.
Involuntary termination. You're saying something in which, you know,
right.
The company,
so you were fired or laid off.
So laid off was part of it, not just fired.
Right.
Okay.
And then the other instance would be that you called out sick and we were like, this is the last time you've called out sick. You're done because you call out sick too often.
And we found out it's not really sick.
Right. So the awkwardness of trying to enforce that, we were glad that Elkred decided not to move forward
that bill.
It was a very, very kind of niche bill. And then we even had a bill that they wanted to bring back mandatory paper pay stubs if the employee...
Oh, dear Lord. Has somebody let them know the 80s have passed?
Well, for employers over the size of 100, and then they modified it down to the size of 50 employees or more. And for us, if you want a pay stub on paper, your employer has to do that for you now. That's by law. They have to give you the opportunity to print it out at work at no cost to you.
That's right.
So if you want that every week, you can ask for it every week, and it's the employer's obligated to give you a paper pay stub. There's nothing prohibiting that in the law right now. So we were able to clarify that law was was basically in effect already if it was the workers' preference.
Wasn't the printing industry coming in to try
Well, I think it could be a paper-related positive side for Maine's paper industry, but we're such a small state that that's not triggering a huge...
Nope.
That's not going to rescue Maine's paper industry.
No, that most certainly is not. We'd probably end up getting paper from overseas. Just that's my guess is what actually would happen.
Unfortunately, it's probably
yes. true because it would be cheaper to do that.
So those are some examples of some of the bills that have been offered. I think what we're seeing is the first two we talked about were national trends, and the second two were instances where legislators are well-meaning but don't necessarily check to see what the law is now and what would be a complication of that bill before they put the bill in.
Okay. So I know we're talking about national trends here, and one of the things that we kind of briefly talked about at the beginning was minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things going on with minimum wage nationally.
Right.
There's locally a lot of things going on. If we're talking the city of Portland, we're talking about the state. So what's happening with all this minimum wage talk at the moment?
Well, we started the session with nine bills that affected minimum wage. One was really about eliminating the tip credit more so than solely the minimum wage. But there were basically nine bills that dealt with the minimum wage, ranging from $8 an hour, so going from $7.50 in the state of Maine to $8, all the way up to over $12 an hour. And that bill included eliminating the tip credit and also adjusting it to the Consumer Price Index or the CPI going forward. LCRED, there was basically a day-long hearing on all of the bills, and LCRED voted 7-6 with a majority report and a minority report, where the majority report was going to raise the minimum wage, I believe, to $9.50, stepped over a few years. The minority report included raising the minimum wage to $9, but also doing some changes that the department had advocated for youth employment laws that would have broadened the number of hours and some of the places where youth could work, teens could work. And they also wanted to ensure that there was one statewide minimum wage. Both those versions were debated on the floors of the House and Senate, but both ended up not being able to get enough votes to pass. So no bill on the minimum wage ended up coming out and being sent to the governor. So there's still, with those bills failing, there still is a move to do the statewide referendums. So that's what we're looking at next. There could be a minimum wage bill coming back in January for the short session. I don't know what would happen with that. But in the meantime, the signatures are being collected for the statewide minimum wage and also the Portland municipal wage. So there's a Portland ordinance that's not finalized yet, is still being worked out. But there's also a local ordinance referendum in Portland and then the statewide referendums.
So we're a little bit in a waiting mode to see what happens and what actually comes forth from the referendum and also if something comes out in January. And we don't really know fully what's happening in Portland yet, of course. We know what passed.
Right.
But now they're talking about, you know, some changes to that.
What they passed was not what they apparently intended. So right. They're going to go back and look at that. And we at the state, the governor did put forward a bill that would have had one minimum wage statewide. We called it the minimum wage consistency bill. But many states have that. That is not unheard of. The idea of it is not to remove local control, but to clarify for employers and for workers and make it easier to understand where the labor law borders kind of.
Yeah, end. I mean, as we've talked about before on the show, the local ordinance, really what they want to do and what the intent is and what the actual laws of the state conflict a little bit there. So it depends on where you're working, when you're working, how
right.
long you're working. And, you know, it's very complicated.
Right.
And that's the challenge with having local minimum wages versus a statewide wage.
And we have a lot of businesses that are not based in Portland, but have workers who go in and out of Portland. And so where do they go to get their rights enforced? If you're a home care worker, but your office is in Westbrook, but your client is in Portland, you are due the Portland minimum wage, if you make deliveries in Portland, if you cover shifts in Portland, you know, 2 days a week, those kinds of things are going to be issues, and it's going to be hard for Portland to, or we're looking at how is Portland going to be able to do that enforcement on companies that aren't physically located within their borders.
So the one other referendum is the actual marijuana recreational use mm-hmm. bill that's coming out, and I don't know what the official title is
right.
of it. Has the Department of Labor started to think about how that may be affected if that goes into 16 on the ballot, and some of the regulatory requirements that you know will follow this type of rule?
Right. So we had a bill with changes to the drug testing. So for us, our jurisdiction is only in terms of workplace safety and drug testing. And the Senator Andre Cushing, who is, I believe, the Assistant Senate Minority Leader and also on LCRED, he also put in a bill. And in his bill, he added a component to have a work group with DHHS and DOL and any interested parties to look at particularly the marijuana issue and medical marijuana in particular, because we don't know whether marijuana is for recreational or personal use would be legalized yet. But so that bill ended up not passing, and we held over the department's bill, but we have done the work group anyway without having to, we don't need the legislative authority to have a group of interested parties get together. So this past summer and into the fall, we have been holding work group meetings on different aspects of the relationship and intersection between a medical marijuana use in particular in the workplace. And those are very productive and informative. We've had a number of both labor law employer and employee attorneys and representatives from major employer organizations, the hospital association, from the medical marijuana industry, from insurance companies, and also the involvement of medical review officers in these meetings. Public safety has sent representatives there for how they're gauging impairment. So we believe we'll get some useful information out of this that we can bring to the legislature. Now, whether that's changing the drug testing statute or whether we have to propose different legislation that would actually go over to the DHHS side of the house because they actually regulate medical use of marijuana, that remains to be seen, but it's extremely productive. And some of these work groups, you know, people fall off as you keep having another meeting and another meeting. And in this work group, more and more people are hearing about it and joining it. So the group has actually grown, and we've added additional sessions.
Well, it's interesting. I spoke to Patricia Rossi, who is obviously mm-hmm. one of the people who has been dealing with that group. She heads up one of the largest medical marijuana organizations east of Colorado. And she was on the show and talked about it. And she said that it was more of an education session for her, as well as she was trying to educate others.
Right, right.
Right, to try to involve people in understanding what's fact, what's fiction, but there are real perception issues,
mm-hmm.
and then there are issues that are generated or created, and she was very clear that it looks at it as it should be treated just like any other substance, and she said on the air that she would like it to be treated just like alcohol in terms of that, so that if an employer, you come to work impaired, and you're impaired with alcohol, you can terminate them. And so I asked, would you agree that you should do the same thing if somebody comes to work impaired with under medical marijuana? She said, absolutely. That is not the same as some of the other groups here in the state
right, right.
who want to recreationally change it. And so it's an interesting, there seems to be some information difference between the groups even within
right.
that side.
And what we're seeing is how, you know, right now the drug testing statute is guidance for employers who want to be preventative and have some kind of measure, objective measure. Well, that objective measure is invasive because we're taking bodily fluid or a piece of hair or something from you, and we have to have a way to basically coerce you into giving that to us. So there may be another way to look at it in terms of impairment where it's not invasive, where we do kind of, you know, look at your eyes, look at your movements, We can smell it on you. We can make a non-invasive assessment. And do we have to have an objective standard for that? Or can we just say it's more likely than not that you are impaired and you are not safe for work? And that could be due to prescribed painkillers, which are totally legal, as opposed to even the medical marijuana piece, where and that's where it gets tricky, because there still is the medical component. So you get into issues of, I have a disability, you can't ask me about the disability and those kinds of things. So where is the line between what you can right. ask that's and exactly what you can't right. ask? And that's true. Where we get into the gray area with federal law and state law. Yeah. And HIPAA and the ADA and accommodating and all those other kinds of
and
things.
All the acronyms that go along with
yes,
it.
Yes, yes.
We're talking with Julie Rabinowitz, the Director of Policy, Operations, and Communications for the Maine Department of Labor. We're talking about the legislative update for the 127th State Legislature. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAKorea.com. And we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz, the Director of Policy, Operations, and Communication for the Maine Department of Labor. You know, I was just thinking, since this is your new title,
yes,
why don't we add a few more words? Policy, operations, communications, and everything else that I need to do. How's that?
There you go. The commissioner needs to do.
And anything else Gene or Paul need me to do. How about we just add that right onto the title? What do you think?
It's Julie? Okay. But, you know, there's others in our department who have even longer titles. So I'm still... It all fits on the card.
That's good. I was going to say the cards must be getting bigger. Or maybe you can have round cards that go around the edge and they can spiral. It'd be great. Yeah. Okay. All right. That's my legislative rant for a moment. All right. So we're talking about legislative update here for the 127th State Legislature, Maine State Legislature. One of the things that I did have to ask you about is what happened to Right to Work? Because I thought this was going to be a big push.
Well, we did have another day. We had about five bills that had a right-to-work component. Two were proposed by the department. Several bills were proposed by Representative Larry Lockman, who's been a strong supporter of right-to-work. He also is a member of the LCRED committee. And he's a former union member and had concerns about what his money was paying for in dues and whether or not he wanted to be a member of the union and have them represent his views politically or not. So we had the Right to Work today. We had representatives from the National Right to Work organization come up to Maine, and they testified as well as, you know, it was a packed house, overflow room, a full day, several hours of testimony. You know, in Maine, we have a strong tradition of labor rights, and the question is, what does right to work do to that? And what I said in my testimony in favor of right to becoming a right to work state is that if you love your union, you can keep your union. It doesn't take away your ability to join the union, but if you do not want to be a member of the union, then you have that option, and you don't have to pay the other fees. So The bills were again split decisions and went to the floor, but I think that the momentum for building continues, because when we look at states that have gone right to work recently, very traditional labor oriented states,
for example.
Michigan, yeah. Indiana, and Wisconsin. Indiana's governor said that the phone rang off the hook with businesses that wanted to relocate and open up and expand in Indiana once they became right to work. We're not getting that in Maine. And we looked at wages, and in Maine is the right to work. The non-right to work states do have, on average, higher wages than the right to work states. But those include states like California, New York, and Massachusetts, and they are going to skew because they're already at the highest levels of the wages nationally. Anyway, we are 46th in wages in the country, and we're 24th out of 25 in the non-right-to-work states. I would rather see Maine, and the department administration's position is, we'd rather be number one in wages of the right-to-work states than number 24 of the non-right-to-work states. We have an opportunity to attract more business to Maine if we do become a right-to-work state.
Now, will this be coming back up? Do you think that this is something that's going to continue to try over the next couple of years as, you know, the governor and so forth have made this a pillar of what they're looking to do?
I think it's going to continue to come back. This issue is trending nationally to go over to a right-to-work state just to compete with other states. So I think that this, again, is one of those national things that's going to continue to come back. I think in Maine, it's going to depend on the makeup of the legislature as to whether or not it passes. But it's also about educating people about where we are competitively with other states, where our wages are, and what bringing a Volvo plant to Maine would do to a Brunswick Landing or to a Loring in the way that some of those plants that went to South Carolina did. When companies are looking for site selection, they can't publicly state, we'll only look at right-to-work states, because they could be sued for being hostile to labor. But is it one of their criteria? Yes.
Of course. Of course. If you can have a better decision for your employees and for your organization, why would you not do that? That's shareholder responsibility.
Yes, exactly.
101
exactly.
Terms of that. Absolutely. So one last question on that. How close was it to passing? If you would, you know, I know they do, you know, vote internal polling. Was it close? Was it not even close? Or is it going to require a major shakeup of the legislature?
I think the knowledge that it was not going to pass the House freed some people who might have voted for it if there had been a better opportunity for it to pass the House. If there had been a few swings, I think we would have seen a closer vote.
Okay, got it.
It's a tough one. If you have a district and you're Republican and you have a lot of union members and you know it's not going to pass, do you have an incentive to vote for it, even though in your heart you might think that that's the right thing to do? It's a tough call.
Well, that's the part that I always say. You know what? Sometimes you need to vote the right decision. And I recognize you represent your district. I fully get that. But if it's right for the state, it's right for the state, period.
Well, and I think we need to understand that competition drives up wages. And if we can bring in a few more large employers who take the place of the few large employers we've been losing through the closing of the mills, those are good jobs for those people. And they will drive up wages because we'll be competing for more workers. And we'll bring more people into the state.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So let's now switch over to laws that actually did pass. We've talked a little bit about trends. We've talked a little bit about what didn't pass. We've cried in our Cheerios, and now we're moving on. By the way, I'm going to ask my producer a question. Debbie, because I said the word Cheerios, do I have to say that it's through General Mills? Or do I have to?
No, you can just say Cheerios.
Cheerios, good. Yes. Thank you. Just checking, you know, one of those big important things here. We want to make sure we're saying it correct here on the air. All right, what was passed? What laws passed, and what can we look forward to coming down the pike?
Well, we had some things that passed that I think are good. The department put forth a bill that we talked about in our preview several months ago when I was on with you, and that is the Unemployment Insurance Successor Law. And that's a positive pro-business bill that's also pro-employees because it allows a business to be bought and have the new owner have a choice of a lower unemployment rate, unemployment tax rate, without it going into bankruptcy. Under the statute that existed before we passed this bill, businesses only had a choice of a lower unemployment rate if they were buying the business out of bankruptcy. And in that case, probably workers had already been laid off, they were collecting unemployment, the business had a bad reputation, all those kinds of things. This allows the business to be bought and gives the new owner the choice of a lower unemployment tax rate before going to bankruptcy. So that'll be something that we will have some more information coming out. We've got to update the rules about that, but that will be some pretty minor changes, and we expect really no opposition. No one came and testified against this bill. It was not controversial.
It's pretty much a no-brainer, I think, in this case. Sure.
And then another bill that passed, which was not a department bill and has a kind of convoluted story, was LD 921, which ended up combining the original LD 921, which was about domestic violence leave, with the bill that was originally LD 686, which was about the employer's ability to ask for employees' passwords to email and social media. So they're kind of both separate things, but they fall under Title 26 in the Bureau of Labor Standards because they're about employment law. And they are now the domestic violence bill was really a change to an existing bill. So we can talk about that, and then we can talk about the social media piece.
Let's separate them. Go ahead.
So Maine has a statute where victims of domestic violence and or their relatives have the right to not be penalized for needing to take leave on an emergency basis. So if you have to go to court, if you're a victim of domestic violence, and you need to go to court, or your daughter is a victim of domestic violence and you need to take her to court, or you need to take her to the doctor or to the police station, and it's fairly short notice, and they need to take time off from work to do that, unless it's a provable hardship for the business must grant that leave.
It seems reasonable.
Yeah. So it's they're very narrow exemptions. Only the very smallest of businesses where that's the only person on that shift and there's no backup for whatever reason and it, you know, can really deny that leave.
Sure.
If the under the old law, if the employer did deny the leave request, they were the victim could report that to the Department of Labor. We would investigate, and if we found in favor of the victim, the employer could be fined $200, which was payable to the state of Maine, not to the victim. And there was no additional penalty if the victim was terminated. So if the employer said to the victim, look, you keep asking for leave, your personal life's a mess, why don't you just leave this guy? I can't have you on my staff anymore because you're not reliable. We're done. And terminated that employee, the fine would still only be $200.
Would they have to get the job back?
Under the existing law, no.
Okay.
But the quirk in the existing law was that if they quit voluntarily and said, look, I'm getting stalked, I got to move, I got to do this, I can't work, I got to get my life in order, I got to go away from this person, they could quit, no penalty, they could file for unemployment, they are granted unemployment, and that law still exists under the employment law. You can file for unemployment, and there's no penalty to the employer. And in that case, it's better for the employer to say, look, I think you need to take some time and let's figure out, you know, if you quit, you can get unemployment.
Sure, it makes more sense, you know, of course. I knew that part of it.
Yeah, so we need to be aware of what we need to do for that. So what the advocates were concerned about was that victims are in a tough spot. They're getting denied the opportunity to make money, and there's no penalizing an employer who just kicks them to the curb, essentially. And so they wanted to tighten that loophole and send a message that that's not tolerated. Initially, what they wanted in the initial bill that was proposed was to have a private right of action and have the victim be able to sue, or the family member of the victim be able to sue the employer and also get back wages and the job back. And the department opposed the private right of action because really the businesses that are going to be the ones violating this for the most part are going to be the smallest businesses anyway, where it's going to be a close call as to whether or not they it was truly a hardship or not. So there was a majority report and minority report. The majority report was to keep the private right of action. The minority report was to put in fines and damages. And that is the bill that ended up, the version and amendment that ended up passing as LD 921. So what the bill now requires is that in instances where leave has been denied, the fine is now $1,000 and that goes to the state. But then the victim receives treble damages of the fine. So the victim receives $3,000. So that's a big change.
It's huge.
And I think that what we're doing at the department is we're going to do better education to employers so they're aware of this. And what we don't want and what we didn't want before was the employer who says, look, you're just a mess and we can't have you on our staff. This is your, we can't cover for you. This is not working out. In that case, if they do violate the law and terminate the employee, they have the choice of the $1,000, and we investigate, they make a complaint. Now they have to make the complaint within 6 months. So there is a sunset provision, a statute of limitations on when they can make this complaint. But if we investigate and find in favor of the victim, they have their choice of $1,000 in the treble damages, the $3,000 damages back to them, or they can request back wages and reinstatement of their position.
You know, it's interesting about that, which is, I mean, I understand what they've done and I get the law. I want to make sure that employers understand that in this particular case, you're talking about if you do it wrong.
Right.
Right. Now, if you have an employee that's still not performing well,
correct,
and maybe caused by their personal life. And see, this is where it blends.
Yes,
right?
This is and where this the is a really critical a issue because we have cases in unemployment of victims, but they're not fired because they're victims. They're
that's
fired
right.
because of misconduct.
Right, and so that's where the line really draws a really gray line down the line, period. So I just want to make sure employers understand that, yes, you do have to be aware of this, but this doesn't stop employers from being able to discipline if necessary.
Right. And the real critical factor there, as always, yes,
documentation.
Yep.
That's right. No question about that.
Yep.
Okay. So we've talked about, now let's go into the social media part.
So the other side of this, of what ended up being passed as 921 was the social media bill, which was 686. And that bill, the goal of that bill was based, actually, I was having a conversation with the labor law attorney the other day, and he was saying that this bill originated with the New Jersey Department of Corrections, which had the brilliant idea of asking on their application for the social media password of the people they were interviewing for corrections officers so they could see if they really had some issues that might be problematic as corrections officers, you know, drug use, you know.
Yes,
things
anything
that might
having
be an
to
issue.
Do that,
contraband.
That people shouldn't put on their
yes.
social media pages, but do.
Right. So this is, again, a national trend, and a couple states have passed laws. Now, the law that was initially proposed, again, had a private right of action. Now, I think what I've learned here is that people think the private right of action is no cost to the government. So it's going to get passed because there won't be a fiscal note. It's not going to have to go to appropriations. But it does get a fiscal note from the judiciary because if you're increasing the number of hearings that have to be held over in the judicial branch, they do have a cost associated
surprise,
with that.
Surprise.
Right. So the choice is it going to be less expensive for the Department of Labor to enforce the law, or is it going to be less expensive for the state to allow people to sue? And it turns out that it's less expensive for the state if the Department of Labor enforces the law in some of these cases. So essentially, the idea behind this law is that employers should not be asking for your social media password, and they should not be coercing you to open up your social media account in front of them where they can see the personal management side. It doesn't prohibit anyone from Googling or searching and looking at anything that is public and hasn't been locked down with your privacy settings. So if an employer sees something online, that's fine for the employer to have access to. If, say, you have a worker who's harassing a client or coworker and stalking them using Facebook Messenger or another kind of social media messaging thing, or even their own email account, and the person who's getting harassed brings the documentation to you, that is totally fine for you to have and see. The question then becomes, if you don't have reasonable cause to open a misconduct investigation and you're asking employees to show you their personal side of the social media, not the public side, but the personal side, that they will run afoul of this new statute. We were able to work with this. This bill was interesting because it went to the Judiciary Committee, not to LCRED, because it had a rights component, I think is why it got referred there. But really, it ended up being employment law in the end. We argued as the department that this should go to Maine Human Rights Commission because it was an issue about privacy, but it doesn't affect a protected class. So the Judiciary Committee felt that it was more appropriate for it to be under the Department of Labor. Now, there is no other thing that we enforce that falls even remotely close to this, because this is actually a technology-based enforcement.
Right.
The research to prove whether or not your boss asked you that you have a social, you know, hey, can you give me your Facebook password? If you say no, the way the law is written, technically, that's still a violation of the law, because even if you had the wherewithal to say, no, I'm not giving you my password, you know, I'm not bringing in my mail for you to see, and I'm not showing you my email, and I'm not giving you my Facebook password and that kind of stuff, which employees should know they don't have to turn that stuff over, and employers should know they don't have to ask.
Employees shouldn't ask, period.
Right. So, but if they do ask, they're liable to be fined, even if the employee didn't turn it over. The other weird thing about this law that this law doesn't address, and we brought it up in the hearing, but it wasn't part of the scope of what they were thinking of, and so it did not get addressed in the final version of the law. If you use your social media or look up your personal email on your employer's computer, well, all those passwords and access and all that stuff gets stored on the computer.
Correct.
Especially if you've set your browsers to automatically save passwords. So nothing prohibits the employer from having access through that door. In that part of this statute does not address that. So that makes investigation a little more complicated, because if your employer did end up accidentally seeing your Facebook page because you log on from your work computer on your lunch hour and you have the password saved on there, that's technically not illegal.
That's right, because employers, because you're using company property.
Right.
That's right.
So that's an area where we may have to address further in rules. We also, you know, what it does carve out exemptions for employers to ask to see the personal side of these things or to turn over printouts of them would be for investigations of misconduct and also things like trade secrets. So if you're sharing or messaging yourself or emailing yourself documents from work that are not able to be publicly shared, the employer does have a right to pull those up.
We're talking with Julia Rabinowitz. She is the Director of Policy Operations and Communications from the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz, the Director of Policy, Operations, and Communications, and just all around wonderful person at the Department of Labor for the state of Maine. All right, so we've been talking about laws that did pass. There are three more I want to get to.
Yep.
And the first one we're going to talk about is Service Animal Task Force.
Right. So there were a couple bills that addressed, and these were over at the Agriculture Committee, because the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry has jurisdiction over animal welfare, and service animals fall partially under them, but they also fall partially under us because it's an accommodation for a person with a disability to allow them to have a service animal either at work or in a public accommodation. It also does fall under Maine Human Rights Commission because of possible discrimination if you have a service animal. But there's a lot of confusion for housing. What's the difference between a service animal and a comfort animal? Because a service animal is for a specific disability. It has a specific task that it does. And a comfort animal is not quite that. But a comfort animal is allowed under the housing parts of the Maine Human Rights Act, but it's not a workforce accommodation and it's not a public accommodation. So your restaurant does not have to allow your comfort animal, which could be any kind of animal. Could be a cat, could be a chihuahua, could be a snake.
Is not a comfort animal.
I don't think it's a comfort animal,
just
frankly.
Just be clear. I know,
but
I'm probably going to have people that like snakes sending
me. But if
emails.
It comforts you.
No.
But it would. But those are not service animals. Animals are actually for the disability side of the house in public accommodation. Only dogs and miniature horses.
I really do like the fact that that's okay. I get that.
Yes.
I'm just simply saying that one particular.
I understand
animal,
exactly what you're saying.
One particular.
A snake
just
would
say
not be
simple,
my choice for a comfort
You said
animal.
The S word. All right. So
right. But,
I'm telling my producer we're going to cut the S word. No, I'm just kidding.
But we get a lot of questions at the Department of Labor from business owners.
So you said
who are confused
mini horses?
About miniature horses in very limited. There's not. Oh, I mean, obviously they're not widely used, but they do have a specific role to accommodate specific disabilities. Dogs, obviously, the most widely used.
Of course.
And so, kind of what I say to people is if the chihuahua is eating off the plate, that is not a service animal, because service animals are trained to do specific tasks. They don't do their business in the restaurant. You know, they don't have accidents.
They're well-trained.
They're well-trained. They are specifically trained, and they meet the requirements and do a specific task for the person who has a disability.
Right.
You can't ask people, what's your disability? You can say, is that a service animal? And you can say, what is it trained to do? So it alerts me when I'm going to
and
have a seizure.
And typically they're identified anyways. Most people have a...
But there is this black market of buying fake paraphernalia to put it on your comfort animal.
It's very
to
true.
To allow you to take the chihuahua or the snake or whatever into the restaurant or the hotel or whatever it happens to be. And so that's where this challenge comes, because the businesses want to have customers with disabilities who need a service animal to be their patron, but they also are kind of protective of that because they want to reserve that right for the people who truly need it and not just have chihuahuas eating off a plate. So from, and I like chihuahuas. So
So from an office perspective or a business perspective, if the employer allows someone to have a service animal for their employee.
Yes.
Okay. They don't have to allow a comfort animal for their employee.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Right.
Just want to make sure we're clear on that.
Because that's not a disability accommodation. And that's where it gets into kind of a gray area. So this task force is going to be looking at the state statutes. It may be that the state statutes can't really, we've done all we can in the state, and it has to be a national issue, and we need to raise it to the delegation and bring clarity in national law. One of the things they wanted to do was have your town clerk or, you know, city hall issue you a badge for your service animal, and you would go file some paperwork proving you had a disability, proving that the dog was trained. It doesn't have to be trained by an official trainer. It can be trained by you, but it does have to be trained. But the problem is that's just your town issuing it. And if we have so many businesses that are accommodating tourists from other places, and they're not, their service animal's not going to have that badge or that certificate. And then you get into a, well, do you really, you know, because New York State doesn't issue them, and Massachusetts doesn't issue them, and Colorado doesn't issue them. So there may be that we need more national guidance and clarity on that issue, but we do have that task force looking.
Okay, good.
Them.
That's good. Good information. Very good for clarifying.
It's very
that.
Interesting.
Absolutely. The second one is a debt disclosure through unemployment.
Right. So a bill that passed a couple years ago has had a sunset, and it has gotten expanded and continued. And what happens is if the court, you go in court, it's a judgment against you that you owe a debt. They can take that information in the court finding, and the court can order the Unemployment Bureau to disclose where you last earned wages, so they, and how much wages you were earning, so that the debtor can, or the person you owed the debt to, can find you and contact you at your place of work or most recent place of work to help get recover the debt.
Okay, so it's just more of a notification rule or law.
Right. I mean, we're doing the research and telling the attorney or the plaintiff the information, but that is wage data that's reported by employers, and that is going to be used to contact workers at businesses to get them to pay back
the
debt.
That makes sense. All right, the last one we're going to talk about here is a CSSP, which you can explain what that is.
Yep.
Bridge year funding.
So when employers pay their unemployment taxes in Maine, 0.06% of that tax is offset into a different account. And we use that offset in the Competitive Skills Scholarship Fund to pay for the Competitive Skills Scholarship Program, CSSP. And this new bill is going to allow us to use some of that scholarship training money to help pay for kids in the bridge year. And that program's really great, and it should be a big help to kids who are below 200% of the poverty level to get them a two-year degree.
No, that's excellent. I think that makes a lot of sense. Well, you've provided a great amount of information today, Julie.
We're always working on stuff.
As you always do, and certainly we'll have you back early next year to tell us what's happening with the new legislative session.
I'll be happy to do that.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy Operations and Communications for the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m., or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.